Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is May 2nd, 2016, and I'm your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is This is a Simulation for Ultrasound Education. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Chris Bond. Chris is an emergency physician and clinical lecturer at the University of Calgary. He is currently the host of CapeCast, which highlights educational innovations from emergency medicine residency programs across Canada. Chris also has his own FOMED blog called Standing on the Corner, Minding My Own Business, or Sock Mob. Welcome back to the SGEM, Chris.
Thanks very much, Ken.
Well, it must be another SGEM hop from CGEM if you're on the show.
Yeah, Ken. Looking forward to getting another great article out to the foam world.
Love the foam world. So, Chris, how did we do last time with that hypertonic saline for severe TBI episode?
The hypertonic saline for severe TBI generated a good deal of controversy about the most appropriate solution for TBI, and it reached number 5 on the altmetric list for CGEM.
My favorite number! What I thought was great was having the lead author, Dr. Elise Pelletier, on from Quebec, who could do the show in English and in French.
Yeah, I think that definitely adds to the dissemination of foamy goodness. I wonder if we can get today's author to do the Polish edition of the SGEM Hop.
We'll see. But speaking of the lead author, we have him here today, Dr. Paul Olszynski. And Paul is a clinical assistant professor and director of emergency department ultrasound in the Saskatoon Health Region. Paul has recently been appointed director of undergraduate ultrasound education at the College of Medicine at the University of Saskatchewan. Welcome to the SGEM, Paul.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, guys.
Oh, it's our pleasure. And you know what? The University of Saskatchewan, it's turning out to be this real powerhouse of EM education.
Yeah, there's certainly lots of really great stuff happening. We've got the rapid approach to teaching the components of the EM assessment and workup by Rob Woods and his team. We've got the social media index and work around social media for education being spearheaded by Brent Toma. And of course, there's other areas of research like pre-hospital, as well as more broadly, things like point-of-care ultrasound in the undergrad medical education curriculum.
Well, it's great that you could be on and talk about your paper today. So Chris, you're going to give us a case.
Absolutely. So an emergency medicine resident in your institution has learned some basics of ultrasound training, but they're feeling uncomfortable performing ultrasound in a crashing patient. They come ask you how they can learn to use their ultrasound skills in critically ill patients other than doing it in real time.
Well, on today's SGEM episode, we are going to combine some really cool things happening in emergency medicine.
We're going to look at high-fidelity simulation, but also point-of-care ultrasound, or POCUS.
Paul, you wrote the paper on this. Can you give us some background information on these topics?
You know, broadly, you could break down POCUS into two main categories, diagnostic applications and procedural applications. And really, there are now trainers and simulators for both. I'd say when it comes to diagnostic, the most compelling case can be made for the invasive applications, things like transesophageal echo in shock and arrest, or transvaginal ultrasound in first trimester bleeding. On the procedural side, and this is where the bulk of the evidence is, you can make a pretty good case for using them to improve patient outcomes. For example, in one study with Barsik et al., trainees were trained to mastery level on central venous line trainers with the use of ultrasound, and they performed far better on real patients than those trainees who had undergone a traditional go read about it, see one, do one approach. And then there's this movement towards hybridized sim experiences where either diagnostic or procedural trainers are introduced into a broader simulation environment, a clinical context. This type of bridging from simple task training to a clinical integration in a simulated setting is now being explored more and more, especially as we move towards competency-based training.
Ooh, there's that buzzword, competency.
Absolutely, and it is becoming a buzzword. And without getting into it too deeply, let's maybe just address the fact that assessing competency is not a one-time event. It's not as though seeing the trainee perform a skill, like POCUS, in one instance is sufficient to say they've achieved competence. Assessment of competence requires thoughtful assessment of several instances spaced over time and ranging in complexity, and is here where these types of hybrid simulation sessions offer a window for assessment. seeing when the trainee decides to reach for the transducer, how they hold it, how long they allow themselves to scan for, and how they interpret and integrate those findings into care, this can serve as one of those many touch points making the case for that trainee's POCUS competence. Eventually, with multiple assessment points over the duration of their training, with the formative feedback that's associated with it, they'll achieve competence in POCUS.
Well, Paul, we understand that resuscitative POCUS can be divided into three different parts.
Yeah, so again, you're going to see different versions of this, but I think really it comes down to firstly, like a firm grasp on the indications and knowing when and where to scan. The second part is the image generation with the simultaneous interpretation. So generating images means you know how to generate them to achieve that perfect image on the screen that allows you then to extract data. And then the last piece, of course, is integration into clinical care. And that's making the decisions based on all the data of the vitals, the physical exam, the history, as well as the POCUS data that you've managed to extract.
And then you mash up this high fidelity simulation with POCUS, and you're using that to teach the residents?
Yeah, we noticed over the past few years that trainees seem pretty nervous about reaching for the transducer during actual resuscitations. What we thought is that we could introduce resuscitative point-of-care ultrasound in a less high-stakes setting and give them the opportunity to start working through some of the logistical challenges that they might encounter prior to making them try it on a real patient.
And are any other programs doing this or just the U of S?
There are several other institutions that are taking a crack at this in their own way. I'm going to give a shout out to Dalhousie's Dr. Paul Atkinson in St. John, who actually published a paper called UltraSim, where they used a very similar ultrasound simulator as the one that we developed here in the University of Saskatchewan, as well as to Dr. Seth Perlman at the U of T there at Mount Sinai, who also has integrated this into their setting. So they were some of the earliest to kind of adopt this as we were kind of initially, you know, presenting abstracts and getting some buzz around the integration of ultrasound into critical care simulations. And now I think it's becoming quite standard. There are maybe different ways of doing it, but even at last year's CAPE SimWars, ultrasound was part of the resuscitations. They had a probe under the bed, and the minute the trainee put it in the right place, the video went up and the whole audience was able to interpret the images. So I think it's becoming increasingly standard fare. The question now is, what's the best way to do it?
So what was the purpose of your study then, Paul?
So the purpose of our study was to evaluate two comparable ultrasound simulation interventions as used during high fidelity simulation, as well as contrast them against previous experiences that trainees had had. The idea with using two somewhat similar but distinct interventions allowed our study team to assess and isolate for the potential value of things like handling a transducer and having to move a ultrasound machine around a room. So that gave us a little more detail than perhaps just comparing it to only one intervention.
Okay, Chris, what's the clinical question?
All right, Paul. So what ultrasound simulation method is preferred by trainees and instructors in high fidelity simulation?
What's the title of your paper, Paul?
Ultrasound During Critical Care Simulation, a Randomized Crossover Study, published in CGEM 2016.
All right, let's go through the PICO. What was the population?
Emergency medicine residency program trainees and eight instructors, five of whom were staff physicians, three of whom were senior emergency medicine trainees with significant ultrasound experience.
And what were the two interventions they were looking at, Chris?
So yeah, there were two interventions. The first was the EDIS-2 POCUS simulator, which is comprised of a modified ultrasound probe and laptop. And the second was a laptop with ultrasound videos placed on an audiovisual cart.
And Paul, what were you comparing this to?
So that's an important question. So both these interventions were compared to previous experiences with ultrasound in critical care simulation. To give you an example of some of the things our trainees described and things that we had heard of in the past, being provided with a still image of some finding, being told over the PA system what the size of the abdominal aorta was, or a machine that's not turned on, that is grabbed, kind of moved around the room, and then when it's time to actually know what the results are, being told them right there during the simulation scenario.
And what was the outcome that they were looking for in this study, Chris?
They were looking at trainee and instructor preference.
And Paul, what were the authors' conclusions?
The EDIS II was identified as being a superior teaching intervention as it allowed for greater functional integration of POCUS into critical care, better assessment of trainee skills, and had greater impact on session debriefing and formative feedback.
All right, let's go through the quality checklist for observational trials, Chris. Question number one, the study population, was it focused on those in the emergency department?
Yes, it focused on emergency medicine trainees who would normally be performing the intervention.
And the groups, were they adequately randomized?
No, it was not a random allocation method, as groups were selected as every other trainee based on the order of arrival to the sim lab.
And the randomization process, was it concealed?
No, it was not.
All right. And the study participants, were they analyzed in the groups which they were randomized?
Yes, they were, but this is a crossover study, so all participants completed both interventions.
And the study participants, were they recruited consecutively?
Yes, they were.
And the patients in both groups, were they similar with respect to prognostic factors?
Yeah, all the mannequins had similar comorbidities and prognostic factors.
All right. And all participants, were they unaware of their group allocations?
No, they knew which groups they were going to be in.
Were they treated equally, though?
Yeah, absolutely.
And did they get complete follow-up?
Yep, I think everybody had to stay around and be followed up that day.
And were all important outcomes considered?
Yes, they were.
And the treatment effect, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
We're unsure about this.
Okay, well, we'll have to talk to Paul about that further. Let's go through the key results, though. There are 25 trainees with an average pre-intervention multiple choice question exam of 72% based on the American College of Emergency Physicians MSONO online exam.
So this means they were familiar with POCUS.
Yeah, and 21 of the 25 had already had their level 1 POCUS course or equivalent.
They also reported that their high fidelity simulation to date had been poor, with a score of 3.2 out of 10.
So, Paul, what do you think the primary outcome of your study was?
So I think the key result is that trainees and instructors rated these two study interventions superior to previous critical care ultrasound simulation, with EDIS II being the preferred method of the two.
Okay, let's get a little deeper into those results then. Because the trainees were asked how well the simulation scenario addressed five aspects of the resuscitative POCUS.
The five categories were knowledge of indications, image generation, image interpretation, clinical integration, and resuscitation choreography.
And the responses were a quantitative assessment on a Leichhardt scale.
Trainees rated the EDIS II and the laptop as a better experience than previous experiences. There was no significant differences between the two teaching interventions.
Then the trainees had this qualitative survey done a few weeks after the course.
All the respondents indicated they preferred the EDIS II. Reasons included primarily the themes of real-time handling of the ultrasound probe with the EDIS II, as well as hands-on use. The laptop alone was felt to be a more artificial intervention.
And the instructors were also asked about the intervention, and both the quantitative and qualitative data support the preference for the EDIS II over the laptop intervention as well as previous experiences. But let's talk a little nerdy here.
The findings of this study seem to support the integration of POCUS, whether by a simple laptop model or an EDIS II model.
But to go deeper and understand this, we're going to ask Paul you a few questions. Chris, can you lead it off?
Sure. Paul, the first question we have is about randomization. So you just allocated every other trainee based on their order of arrival to the sim lab, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. There was a challenge with randomization because we never really knew who was going to come on a given day. So we decided we would use their order of arrival to the simulation center at Whips Cross Hospital as part of our randomization. As they walked into the center, we provided them with an envelope that included their group allocation. We had arranged our envelopes and to alternate from group A to B to A and so forth as a means of ensuring that we had balanced groups in terms of size. It was somewhat reassuring to see that our process did result in two generally similar groups. In the end, there was no statistical significance between the two groups in terms of POCUS and simulation experience, so I guess it worked out.
The second question was the quantitative versus the qualitative data. You used both tools, and it's why and what do you think that they tell us about your study?
Yeah, when it comes to education research, I think combining the two forms of data really enriches the study. It adds insight into the numbers. In our study, it also highlighted how tricky research on students and instructors can be. For example, as we've noted, The trainees initially rated the two interventions very similarly, with no statistically significant difference between the two. Yet on the exit survey, every one of them stated they preferred the EDIS-2 to the laptop intervention.
The third question is about personal bias. You were the lead author, but also were involved in the teaching sessions. How did you try to minimize this bias?
You know, early on, I recognized the fact that I couldn't be a teacher or instructor with any of the groups. So in the end, it was decided that my job would be to simply introduce the trainees to the two interventions. So when they arrived to the SIM Center just prior to their two cases with any intervention, I would explain to them how the intervention worked, how to turn it on, how to seek videos, and that was it. I wouldn't be involved in any of the debrief, and I wasn't involved with any of the formal teaching. My only other contribution was that I was the voice of most of the patients, including their breathing and their calls out for help.
The fourth question we wanted to ask you about was the resuscitative POCUS competency model. And you give this conceptual framework illustrating the key concepts supporting the use of POCUS simulation and high fidelity simulation. Can you take us through that model?
Sure, I'd love to. It is definitely a pretty busy figure or graphic. I think the key here is to appreciate that competence in anything takes time, and it usually is staged or goes through levels. And so if you look at our model here, what we're saying is, you know, it starts with lectures, courses, or reading, introduction to the concepts behind the use of ultrasound in the critically ill patient. Of course, the next step is going to have to be hands-on practice, and that's going to really usually take several experiences to really start to generate some natural sonographic movement or sonographic reflex. And then we think that that next step, that bridge from having practiced on kind of low-risk setting or in the purely training setting, the next step just prior to actually having to do this in the real world on critically ill patients is creating this bridge or this hybrid simulation scenario where you're simulating both the critical care piece and at the same time you're bringing in ultrasound as a means of allowing the trainees to work out the challenges of critical care ultrasound, relate to the precarious state of the patient, the logistical challenges of just multiple competing interests, and how to work that all out while improving patient care.
Well, in your resuscitative POCUS competency model, you've got at the bottom Bloom's cognitive, affective, and psychomotor domains. Can you just tell people what those are?
Be happy to. I think you got to keep in mind Bloom himself has referred to his framework there as being the most cited and least read piece of literature in the education world. But essentially what Bloom's is about is just the fact that we recognize that there's a cognitive or knowledge component to learning, there's an affective or emotional component to learning and valuing, and then there's also the psychomotor domains, which come down to basically the actual movement and developing the skills. And so when you're learning point-of-care ultrasound, all those things obviously have to be engaged in order for it to finally become something that you master.
All right, so that's Bloom's. And what's Miller's framework?
So Miller was this really smart guy who proposed that the way we should assess trainees also falls under kind of a hierarchy or a pyramid. And at the very basis of it, and kind of think about preclinical teaching, pre-clerkship teaching in med school, it's really about just seeing if the student knows the answer. So just strictly questions, multiple choice, whether or written. We're really just interested in seeing whether they know what we're talking about, whether they know the answers and the principles, the concepts. As we move up Miller's framework, we move to things like knows how to do something. So maybe that would be a description. We'd ask them on an oral exam, what would they do next? How would they approach this problem? And then the next step would be for them to show us. And this is kind of exciting because we've now got this technology that really lets us dive into the shows how, where we can, you know, control for all kinds of features or all kinds of parameters and see if the trainee can actually demonstrate what we want them to be able to do, but in the safe setting where a patient isn't at risk. And that's very important when it comes to teaching critical care, of course, because we don't want trainees starting right out the gate on a critically ill patient. We want to have a safe environment where we can actually assess whether they know what they're doing. And of course, the last piece, and this is kind of that end of residency, we want to see if just whether or not that trainee does what we expect them to do. So that's the action part. And that's where, you know, at the end of residency training, you're attending sits back and says, okay, it's time for you to go to work, and I'll just be sitting back here watching you work.
So you mentioned hierarchy, and in this model that you put forward, on the left-hand side, there's Miller's framework, but on the right-hand side, you've got something called Kirkpatrick's hierarchy. Could you explain that?
Yeah, that's another, again, hierarchy or framework that is often referred to in medical education. And what it looks at is the hierarchy of outcomes. And specifically here, what we are going after, or ideally the best interventions, would be those that we see have a direct result on patient care, specifically a positive result on patient care. Those aren't easy things to measure. That's usually quite a complex task to be able to prove that this one teaching intervention resulted in improved patient care. So there's, of course, a hierarchy, and it starts with just seeing whether or not trainees learned from an intervention. And that's something that I think most of us are familiar with. The next step there would be transfer of learning. So if a trainee can learn something in one environment and then show you that they can apply it in different environments, that means they are able to analyze, that means they're able to adjust, and they're able to kind of really tailor it. And so you get the impression that you're moving up, and you're seeing that it's something that they've got a strong grasp on, but additionally, it's something that they're already using now in practice. And again, transfer can be observed or assessed in the simulation setting. And then lastly, there's results where those are actually clinically relevant outcomes and results in patient care. And those are challenging, but certainly the gold when it comes to education research outcomes.
So you've described these other frameworks, and as a band across it, you have something called the zone of proximal development. Can you describe that a little bit?
You know, we've been talking a lot about how we could describe these things in a way that our listeners can kind of see what we're getting at. And I got to tell you, I think the visual for the zone of proximal development is training wheels. Training wheels are that tool or that scaffolding that take us from kind of through not being able to ride a bicycle independently and allow us to move towards that skill of being able to ride independently. It's that scaffold or that support that we use. And the zone of proximal development in healthcare education works much the same way. You have a learner who has a skill that they have mastered, and they can do it independently. But then there might be the next level of skill that they just, it's just slightly out of their reach. And that reach, that space, is this the zone of proximal development, where if someone were to assist them with it, if someone were to give them the right supports, they'd be able to move, and now what was once out of reach is now attainable and doable. And you can look at, you know, different types of psychomotor tasks, but I think ultrasound and recess ultrasound is a great example. So if the trainee can do basic ultrasound, they know how to generate a view of the right upper quadrant, they know how to generate a view of the left upper quadrant, they are able to generate a subxiphoid view of the heart to look for pericardial effusion, but they're not quite comfortable or ready yet to be doing that on a real patient who's critically ill. So what we do is we recognize that's their zone of proximal development in terms of resuscitative ultrasound, and we create an environment where they can start to work through that. So in this case, we created a simulation environment where they can hold the probe, they can figure out when exactly, whether it's in the resuscitation, they're going to go after that transducer and spend some time trying to generate those images. And it gives them an opportunity to see how they're going to react to the findings they might have. All of that in the setting of designating tasks to other members of the team, being aware of the environment, frequently reassessing and reevaluating the situation. So it's that it's creating that opportunity so that that next step will be them using the transducer in the setting of critical care, in the real emergency department, still with the guidance of a senior attending, but now much more comfortable and much more able to push off and make an attempt for it on their own.
Yeah, I really like that comparison to the training wheels model. It's a nice, safe environment for the learner, absolutely. So the fifth and final question we have is about patient-oriented outcomes. Do you have any plans on demonstrating this POCUS high-fidelity simulation has a positive impact on patient-oriented outcomes?
So as we discussed earlier, you can imagine this is going to be quite a challenging study to take on. But yes, of course, it would be, I think, a really logical thing to kind of move forward and see if we can determine if there is a positive impact on patient care. I think there's some important things that we would need to address specifically, it would have to be a multi-centered study because we'd want to account for all the differences or all the different ways that these patients can present. And so we're going to need lots of numbers. We're also going to want to see different trainees from different places so that we have something that we can say in terms of generalizability to the EM training population. So absolutely. And if anyone is listening and is interested in participating in that kind of research, by all means, get a hold of me.
Paul, is there anything else that you wanted to mention before we move on to the next section?
I do, and it's sort of related. I want to just mention that the CAPE Emergency Ultrasound Committee's Education Working Group has been working really hard in the past year here to establish some national objectives and milestones for POCUS EM and Canadian EM residency. We're also hoping to introduce to CAPE the first ever Sono Games at CAPE 17. So we'll be meeting this year in Quebec City, and we look forward to meeting you there. If you'd like to find out what's going on, get an update, or get involved, by all means, check out the website. That's capeultrasound.ca, or get in touch with us by email.
Perfect. Now, Chris, do you want to comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to our conclusions?
I don't think there's too much to comment. We do agree with the author's conclusions.
Well, then can you give us a bottom line?
Yes, you should consider integrating POCUS into your high-fidelity simulation program.
All right, Chris, how about a case resolution with that resident?
You suggest to the resident that POCUS be integrated into a high-fidelity simulation case, either by creating an EDIS II-type trainer with an ultrasound probe and laptop, or simply by putting a laptop with ultrasound clips at the bedside.
And so how are you going to take this paper and integrate it clinically into your practice?
POCUS skills are useful at the bedside in real patients, and this integration into high-fidelity sim is the last step prior to using them in real patient encounters.
And now usually, Chris, what we do here is we have a section called what are you going to tell the patient? But in this case, you've got residents. So what are you going to tell the resident, or what are you going to tell the learners?
We know that use of point-of-care ultrasound during simulation is beneficial for your learning and will help develop your knowledge of point-of-care ultrasound indications. It'll also help your skills of image interpretation, clinical integration of ultrasound images, and resuscitation choreography.
Last week's winner was Eric Schneider. He knew that the tallest building in the world is in Dubai, the United Arab Emirates, and it is 829.8 meters tall, which works out to 160 stories. Paul, do you have any great POCUS question you like to ask the resident?
Sure. How about this one? What POCUS finding is most specific for pneumothorax?
Well, if you know the answer to Paul's POCUS question, then send an email to the sgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Well, that is it for another edition of the SGM Hop.
Now it's time for the SGMers to join the conversation. What do you think about this SGM Hop episode? What questions do you have for Paul and his team on point-of-care ultrasound and high-fidelity simulation? Reach out to us on Twitter using the hashtag SGMHop. You can also look for us on Facebook or the SGM blog. The best social media feedback will be published in CGM.
And just a quick conference update. Paul, you already alluded to it before, but we have a big conference coming up, and that's the Canadian Association of Emergency Physicians, June 4th to 8th in Quebec City. Paul, thank you very much for coming on the SGM and sharing your research with the FOMED world.
Thanks for having me. Dziękuję. That's Polish for thank you.
Oh, do you think you could give the SGM tagline in Polish?
I think it'd be better if I gave that one in English. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time.